Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 195 of Geek Town Radio. I'm back this week with Ross.
Hi Dave, how are you?
I'm all right, how are you?
Yeah, real good, thank you.
We're back to a normal show this week. Now I finally got all my computer problems, which I've been having the last couple of weeks, over. So we're all back up and running properly. What have you been up to then since you've been on last?
Actually, in the past 2 weeks, I suppose, we've had sort of the battle of the angsty Netflix superhero teams in our house. We watched all of The Umbrella Academy and we're sort of three episodes into Titans off the back of that.
Okay.
I think it was a mistake watching them back to back because I enjoyed The Umbrella Academy a lot.
Yeah.
So every episode of Titans, I'm like, is this as good as The Umbrella Academy? Like, I'm comparing them. And I shouldn't do that, really. But I'm enjoying both. They're both really good.
Yeah. Very different sort of shows. I mean, The Umbrella Academy has got that sort of slightly off-the-wall kind of bent to it, whereas Titans is a much more... I mean, still kind of angsty and certainly darker than the CW shows, but it does have much more of a sort of straight superhero thing going on, you know?
Yeah, it feels more DC, whereas Umbrella Academy, I think, is Dark Horse.
Yes.
And it feels very different to other stuff.
Yeah, they do feel very much like that. The way that they've taken Umbrella Academy, I mean, whereas, of course, although they're both on Netflix over here, Titans isn't a Netflix show, whereas Umbrella Academy is. So, and they do very much feel like those sort of two separate elements. But yeah, no, I enjoy both of them. Titans, I don't know, it had a few issues in places with Titans, but certainly Umbrella Academy I thought was great.
Yeah, but very occasionally. So I used to spend a lot of time laughing at Gotham, right? Because Gotham's a very good show, but the visual effects aren't always tight.
No.
We're getting ready for that with Titans. Certain things aren't as polished as others, but Titans on the whole is really good. But The Umbrella Academy, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that there is a chimpanzee in a lot of The Umbrella Academy.
Yes.
And I think it's one of the finest pieces of CGI animal making I've ever seen. He's really good all the way through. He's really good.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of walking, talking chimpanzee. And
yes.
I do wonder if they mo-capped it, motion captured that, I suspect, because it has that sort of feel to it. I suspect it's a motion captured performance. But I mean, I could be wrong about that, but that would be my suspicion.
But yeah, even down to his fur and the way his mouth moves stuff, he feels very, he's very believable. I really liked it.
Yeah.
The production value, all in all, on both of them has been pretty good so far.
Yeah,
real good. We're very much enjoying Titans as well.
Titans comes to a bit of an abrupt end for me. So I'm looking forward to them doing more of it. And they are definitely doing more of it because they've cast Superboy in the second season. So,
yes.
So they are going to be doing more of it. But yeah, it sort of felt like half a season, that, a little bit.
Oh.
It has a finale, but it did feel a bit like a mid-season finale, not an ending finale to me.
Oh, that's interesting.
There are some reveals, but I sort of feel like it could have been a bit longer. But yeah, anyway, I mean, you know, both good shows though.
Yeah, great. So that's what we've been up to. How about you, Dave?
A few different things. Flack, which is this show this original show, which is on the W channel, I'm really, really enjoying. I mentioned it a few weeks ago when we did the sort of last main show. It's essentially a bit like if you took the premise of something like Ray Donovan in that it's a fixer and wrapped it in a kind of suit shell because it has very much that sort of feel to it. But it's all set in London and it's all very much done with a sort of London bent to it, even though it's Anna Paquin starring as the lead. So it's this weird mishmash of sort of American style show, but very much done in England.
Right.
So yeah, but it's interesting. She plays this PR executive. She's living in London. She's there to try and spin things for her various clients who are generally awful people, pretty much. And they're celebrities who kind of get themselves into hot water, and she's there to kind of spin her way out of, you know, spin
sure.
their way
so
out
she's
of
a bit more of like a formal fixer. Her job is to put a good spin on things and everything works out okay.
Yeah. But she does, you know, she finds herself covering up kind of drug taking and all that sort of stuff. So Anna Paquin is the main lead in it. It's got Mark Warren in it as well. It's really, really solid. And the whole thing, I think, is actually up to binge your way through on various streaming platforms, whatever the W streaming platform play. Is it part of Play, maybe? I don't know.
Could well be.
Yeah.
Flack is the word for a publicity agent. I didn't know that.
No, neither did I.
I was like, where does this come in? Why is this called this?
given that we're both kind of PR adjacent, kind of should have probably known that.
Seems like someone would have tapped us on the shoulder and told us at some point.
Yes. So, yeah. Only 6 episodes long for that first season. So well worth going to watch. It's really solid. So I've been watching that. Also 6 episodes long, actually, Afterlife, which is the new Ricky Gervais show.
Yes, I've heard a lot about this.
It's very interesting and I don't think at all what people will probably expect. I mean, it's got a lot of, obviously, Ricky's humour in it. There are jokes. It's incredibly dark, though. The premise is, I'm sure you've seen stuff about it, but the basic premise is Ricky plays a guy who has lost his wife. He is utterly devastated, obviously, by this, and has sunk into a very deep depression to the point that he's talking about killing himself. And he then takes the attitude of, I am not going to take any crap off anybody. I am just going to tell everybody how I think it should be. And what's the worst that can happen? The worst that, you know, I've always got my fallback plan, which is to kill myself.
Right.
That's essentially the setup of it.
And it's almost like a superhero in some ways.
Well, yeah. I mean, and he does talk about it being a bit like a superpower.
Right.
So that's the sort of place that it starts off at. And it just gets very, very dark. And I don't want to give too much away. It's not quite as comedic as maybe you think it would be.
Great.
You know,
it's a great advertisement for it.
Well, it's a really, really good show. I'm not saying it's not funny. It's just not as comedic as you would expect it to be necessarily. Right. There are some great lines. There are some great sort of the Ricky Gervais thing of hiding behind your hands of going, my God, I can't believe he's said that. But it also has got some very kind of poignant stuff in it. And, you know, it deals a lot with depression and grief and a lot of that sort of stuff. So it's really kind of interesting and different to some of the other stuff that he's done before. It's an odd series because it really isn't what you think it's going to be when you step into it. But again, it's only 6 episodes long. They're only half an hour each-ish. You know, it's a Netflix half hour of sort of 25 to 33 minutes, you know, that sort of thing. Well worth watching. Strange and sort of different, but I would say definitely go and watch it. I would say if you're considering suicide, don't go and watch it. But there are people out there that you could call, and there's the Samaritans and, you know, check out those outlines and stuff. But it is a very dark series, and but it is interesting and certainly worth watching. Other things that I've been doing this week, I've actually started to watch some movies again.
There's an audible gasp there.
Yes, Bohemian Rhapsody was the first thing that I caught up with, and it's a little bit,
isn't it?
Yeah. I think Rami Malek is amazing as Freddie Mercury. I think that is a brilliant, brilliant performance. The film itself is a bit Lifetime Movie of the Week. It's a bit sort of tab A into slot B kind of, you know.
It's very nice about it, isn't it?
Yeah. And
it seems like everyone got along fine and everything's fine.
Yeah, and it did sort of skip over certain bits, and I don't know, it is tricky. I don't think it's a brilliantly written film necessarily, and I certainly don't think it deserved to win Best Picture, which I mean it didn't, but the fact that it got nominated I think is quite a surprise on that point of view. But I think Rami Malek certainly deserved to win for Best Actor, because I thought that was an outstanding performance from him. But the film as a whole, it is worth watching, certainly if you're a Queen fan. And some of the stuff in terms of the recreation of the Live Aid gig, I thought were quite phenomenal. And there were things in there that I didn't know in terms of the stuff that they sort of went through and the relationship with the almost wife. So, you know, that sort of stuff, it was kind of interesting and there was an interesting background, but it does play out a little bit like a Lifetime movie. It's not
I did hear that in that vein. Now, I'm not sure. I'm not the biggest Queen fan, but I did hear that parts of it didn't happen. Like certain dates are wrong and certain reasons for certain things aren't completely accurate.
Right. Okay.
Like you say, if you take it with that pinch of salt that you're sort of here to enjoy it, really.
Yeah.
Rather than to get a factual account of events, then yeah, it feels all right.
Yeah. I think that's probably fair. But it is worth going to watch. I think even if it's just for Rami Malek's performance in it, but it's not the best film I've seen. Oh yeah, certainly. The other thing I watched was First Man, which is about the moon landing and mainly centered around Neil Armstrong, obviously being the first man on the moon.
It's Ryan Gosling, yeah?
Yes, it's Ryan Gosling. Ryan Gosling, who seems to have sort of one fairly deadpan acting style, as far as I can tell, which he uses to full effect in this. It is Ryan Gosling kind of playing Ryan Gosling being Neil Armstrong. Claire Foy plays his wife, and she's great. Corey Stoll plays Buzz Aldrin, who is obviously the next man in the moon. And Pablo Schriever, who is an American Gods as well, plays Jim Lovell. Oh, and Lucas Haas, who plays Michael Collins, who was the guy that was stuck in the command module. So very, very rarely gets mentioned at all during when you talk about Apollo 11. Right. So really solid film. Really enjoyed it. It kind of tells you quite a lot about the Apollo missions. And I have to say the sound design in it is phenomenal. I mean, the stuff when they're testing the planes, initially, because Armstrong's a test pilot and they're sort of doing plane tests and they're showing him sort of just the utter lunacy of some of the stuff they're putting in. Basically sticking a large rocket on the back of a tin can and firing it somewhere is essentially what they were doing. And just the creaking and the kind of rattling sounds, and you know, there's very little other noise and you get just that. And it's the same when some of the rockets take off. It's really kind of pushes you inside that space. And the sound design is really phenomenal in it. It shows you a lot about the process of how they got there. And like I say, some of the lunatic things that they did to get to that point, because they were utterly determined that they were going to beat Russia to be landing on the moon.
Yeah.
It was complete insanity, but they managed it, which was phenomenal. They did it, which was phenomenal. If you're interested in those sort of historical biopics, this is definitely one worth going to see. And it's really beautifully put together. As I say, Ryan Gosling kind of seems to have one level, as far as I can tell, in terms of his acting, but he was perfectly fine and perfectly workable as Neil Armstrong. So that will work fine. And Captain Marvel, also I saw this week.
Here we go. This is why we came here, Dave.
So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. I mean, a lot of people saying, well, it's no Black Panther. Well, no, but I don't kind of
it's
think
a different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like saying, well, it's no Infinity War, and it's like, well, yeah, but it's not going to be those movies. I mean, Black Panther was a really amazing film, and Infinity War was the culmination of like 10 years work. So I think that's slightly unfair. I thought it was really solid. I think Brie Larson's great as Captain Marvel. It's always wonderful to see Samuel L. Jackson in it. The de-aging they've done in Samuel L. Jackson is great. Ah. Really, really good. I think it works really well. They've done the same with Clark Gregg as well.
Yes.
Who pops up a little bit. Not all that much, but he you kind of get the impression from the trailers he might be into a bit more, and he's not in it quite as much as you think he's going to be.
I see.
Jude Law in there as well. Lee Pace. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting because it's not a character that I knew particularly Introduces the Skrulls, which is not giving anything away because we know that from the trailers, but it's going to be interesting to see whether they use that at all moving forward, because the whole thing's about Skrulls is they're shapeshifters and they can take on the faces of anybody that they come into contact with. And you do wonder whether they're going to maybe do that moving forward a little bit. And maybe because they've had what they call Secret Invasion, I think is the storyline in the comic books. So they've had those, a couple of those, two or three of them.
Turns out they're everywhere.
Yeah, and this, where the it turns out that certain heroes have actually been Skrulls. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see whether they're going to run with that a little bit more moving forward, which makes this a fairly key movie. You know, if that's the case, it is definitely one you need to see. But I mean, it's one of those things. If you like Marvel movies, the chances are you're going to like this. If you're not into Marvel movies, then why are you watching it? You know, so
I mean, you'll have no context.
We have absolutely no context. It's not one that you can particularly watch out of context. But I thought it was great. I thought it was solid performances all round. Perfect addition to the whole Marvel universe thing. A roll on Avengers Endgame film. I mean, that's the next one to come up. Yeah. I'm very, very much looking forward to that. And then we'll see what state everything is in afterwards.
Have
you not seen Captain Marvel yet, I'm guessing?
No, I think we'll end up going this week. I know a bit about the character. I'm not a fan particularly. I think there are more interesting female characters.
Yeah.
But the, bringing in the sort of a bit more of the spacier stuff, like Guardians did the same thing where it was like very spacey. I think that's valuable as a direction for the whole thing, really, right? So people coming to Earth and getting knocked off by the Avengers can only go so far, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the introduction of Skrulls to the universe is
that's interesting. Yeah,
going to be really interesting. So it helps set things up as they move forward a little bit. You know, and obviously we know she's going to show up in Endgame. Yeah. So perfectly solid, decent film. I mean, on the point that you make about there being more interesting female heroes, you do feel a little bit sorry for Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
Who's been plugging away.
Plugging
away for 10 years and still not her own movie. And they're like, really? This chick? This is the one that's going to that you're going to give a movie first? Thank you very much. So yes, I may be slightly annoyed if I was Scarlett Johansson, but it's still a great film.
Do you remember Justice League where... So the whole thing is they're trying to fight this guy, but they can't fight the guy. So we're trying to get Superman back. We get Superman back. Superman sorted the whole thing out. No problem.
Yeah.
And I really hope Endgame isn't that for Marvel, where she just, we've called Captain Marvel now. We can all sit back and everything's going to get sorted real quick.
I don't think it is going to be entirely that. There is a possibility that there is some of that in there, but I suspect it's not going to be entirely that. I suspect there's going to be other things going on. It has got some post-credit sequences.
Captain
Marvel, it's got two post-credit sequences. The one right at the very, very end of the credits is basically a fun, cute, silly add-on.
I like those best.
The one that's post the initial, the mid-credit sequence, you know, that one has a little bit more to do with Endgame. So,
oh, cool.
So yes, you see a little bit more of Endgame stuff in there.
Stick around.
If you're wondering, they are worth, well, I mean, the one right at the end, if you've got to get off somewhere, don't worry too much about that. but certainly watch the mid-credit one. That's definitely worth seeing. So that's all the stuff I've been doing this week. Let's move on to some TV and film news. TV and film news this week, we start off with renewals, cancellations and pickups again. The first one was a fairly big one. Arrow is coming to an end with a 10 episode season 8 they have announced this week. Lots and lots of stuff floating around about this. I mean, it was the thing that started the Arrowverse, hence it being called the Arrowverse. So it sort of seems right that it's the first thing to go. The decision to end it appears to have come from, well, technically the producers, but really Stephen Amell. Stephen Amell approached them at the end of season 6 and said that he was thinking about, you know, wanting to kind of move on and do other things, pretty much because he's now got a young family and, you know, his life's changed so much and he wants to be able to spend a bit more time, and the hours are punishing on those shows. I mean, they're 22 episode seasons. They're crazy, crazy hours they work on them. He was just trying to sort of ease back a little bit. And initially he actually posted a Facebook video, or he did a live Facebook video, which was very emotional if watching it. And, he was very emotional in it. And he was basically saying, I think he feels a little bit guilty about him leaving, sort of having ended the series, because he was sort of thinking that maybe they could continue on without him. And I can see that actually could be quite possible, but the producers had decided that they're going to bring it to a close, which I think is fair enough. I mean, after eight seasons, it's not like they can't take the actors and shove them into other shows if they wanted to, if people wanted to stay around. And it gets more expensive when you get into sort of eight seasons, because you're having to pay the cast more and more each time they renew contracts. So I think it seems right that that's the one that's coming to an end. There's been lots of lovely things posted from, the rest of the casting crew. There was a lovely thing about from Grant Gustin. He posted on an Instagram post and did a whole sort of half a page worth of really lovely, kind of slightly gushy things about how lovely Stephen Amell is and how we wish they got to work together a bit more. But, the crossovers, even though they're grueling, are amazing. And, I hope to see more of you now that we're not working together, this sort of thing. And Stephen posted a reply saying, "Dude, I was in public. I wasn't prepared to read this." It's really sweet. So yeah, I mean, I am a bit sorry to see you go, but I think it's probably about time. And they've got a Batwoman series coming up, which I think is almost a dead cert for pickup now if Arrow's going to be ending.
That's good.
There are rumors swirling around about how Arrow will likely end. They have got the Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover event coming up, which will be around the 10 episode mark. So people are speculating that Oliver Queen might not make it out of that alive, quite possibly. Whether that's the case, we don't know. He did also say in that Facebook video that he's obviously not entirely gone from the Arrowverse, because if they asked him to come back and do the odd episode, he's perfectly happy to do that.
That's good.
Whether that, what version of Ollie that would end up being, will very much depend on whether they do kill him off or not, but we'll have to wait and see. That Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover is likely to shake things up quite a lot across the whole of the Arrowverse, because that's what it did in the comic books. And I think that's what they're aiming for. Whether it's to mold everybody into one Earth, whether it will include Black Lightning, but basically in the comic books, it takes the multiverse and squashes it all together. So there is a fairly good chance that we might now get Supergirl actually on the same Earth, multiverse Earth, as Flash and all the others. And I do wonder if they may decide to do the same thing with Black Lightning as well, so everything's in one place and they can do crossovers with it. But we'll have to wait and see. There do seem to be some big changes coming up to that whole thing, which, after sort of it being on the air for 8 years, I think that's no bad thing necessarily.
It's a shame in many ways, but when you initially said it, I wondered, because DC have their own streaming service in other parts of the world, don't they? But I wondered if there was some speculation when they finished Daredevil and stuff, if it was because Marvel wanted to move everything to their streaming service that they're going to have, or Disney's rather. And I thought it might have been another political situation like that. In many ways, it's refreshing that he just doesn't want to do it anymore. That's nice.
The difference actually with the Netflix Marvel stuff and the DC CW stuff is the CW is owned by Warner Brothers, who also are owned by DC. So Warner Brothers have like shares in both of them anyway.
So there's no problem there.
So there's absolutely no problem there. They'll keep on doing what they're doing. The DC Universe streaming service, I think, will be kept for its own kind of little universe stuff, which will be the kind of slightly darker things that we've seen with Titans, which they couldn't get away with on the CW. And the CW will carry on doing the sort of slightly lighter shows, which they're doing. Over on Marvel Netflix, there was a very different situation there. And with Disney setting up that streaming service, which is a direct competitor to Netflix, it was very much Netflix decision to cancel them. Marvel were perfectly happy to leave them there. Netflix, for whatever reason, decided that they didn't want to keep running them. Admittedly, some of their viewing figures had gone down from what they seem to be telling us. So it was apparently very much Netflix decision. There is a fair chance that those shows will turn up, but it won't be on the Disney Plus service. If they do reemerge, it's likely to either be on FX or on Hulu, because Disney will own a large stake in Hulu. Once the Fox deal is all complete, they'll also own FX. Both of those are likely places for them. The Disney Plus service itself, they've said, will stay very much PG-13, so a sort of 12 rated thing, and with the best will in the world, even dumbing them down a little bit, or, you know, taking out some of the language and violence, it will be very difficult to do a PG-13 Punisher series and still make it work.
I think I'd like to see it. I think it'd be wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, they've done Punisher cartoons and stuff, but I think it would be quite difficult to do that version of the Punisher under PG-13 rated, so they're not going to end up on Disney Plus service, I don't think. Certainly not initially. Not when they've got other places they could put them. And, you know, FX seems like a good place because they're keeping FX as a brand, by the sounds of it, to put the more mature stuff on. And they also, like I say, have a stake in Hulu. And Hulu have said that, you know, if they want to come up to them with them, they are certainly open to that. Yeah. It looks like there may be an exclusion time between them leaving. You know, it might be like 2 years, it might be 5 years, we don't know, but there may be an exclusion before they're allowed to air it on another station. So, despite the fact that it appears to have been Netflix that cancelled it, there seems to be something in the contract that won't allow them just to move it and air it somewhere else.
Straight away, yeah.
So, I think they will come back at some point. I just don't know when. We'll have to wait and see with those.
Cool.
Moving on, Strike Back has been renewed for an 8th and final season. So, that's the current Strike Back team will be back for one more season after the one that's airing at the moment. I have to say, I didn't watch all of the last season and I need to catch up. It wasn't particularly bad. I just kind of other things got in the way and I didn't get around to finishing it. So I have still got it on my Skybox. I will try and go and finish that. And they've got the new season running at the moment and then they'll have one more season and that'll be it. At least that's what they said. That's what they've said this time. They said that last time and then they brought it back after a couple of years. So we'll see. But at the moment, they're saying that it's definitely ending again. Call the Midwife has been renewed up until 2022. Wow. So they've already shooting the 9th season, which is the one that will go out this year. They've now renewed it for a 10th and 11th season. So yes, that takes it up to 2022. So good news for Called the Midwife fans. ITV has renewed Vera for a 10th season and Endeavour for a 7th season. So those two are back. Death in Paradise has been renewed for 2 more seasons as well. Chicago Fire, Med and PD have all been renewed for their respective new seasons. Brooklyn Nine-Nine has been renewed for its 7th season and its 2nd season on NBC in the US. So all the finger crossing there. It was really cute. They showed a video of them being told in a sort of read through and them all jumping up and down and screaming. It was very, very cute. And Star Trek Discovery has been renewed for a 3rd season as well, which I think was always going to be a bit of a shoo-in. They've introduced a lady called Michelle Paradise as co-showrunner to help out Alex Kurtzman. Alex Kurtzman's basically the guy in charge of all things Star Trek at CBS now. So he's got his fingers in a bunch of different shows right now. So I think they've brought her in. She has been working on the show. They basically promoted her to being co-showrunner for the 3rd season. It seems like a solid idea. You know, she knows what she's doing and she's been there already. So, you know, frees him up to be able to kind of concentrate on some other shows as well. They have got a Section 31 series in the offing as well, which stars Michelle Yeoh. And that's a sort of element which is in the 2nd season. But there is a spin-off series that looks like it is going to happen, but they've said it's a few years off before that's likely to arrive. Sticking with Star Trek, the Picard series, which is one of those spin-off shows which Alex Kurtzman is working on, they have announced a bit of new casting for that. The Picard series, which hasn't got a proper name at the moment, so we're just referring to it as Star Trek : Picard, as in the Star Trek naming convention. They've announced that two people will be joining him. Santiago Cabrera and Michelle Hurd are the two people that are joining him. We don't know a whole lot about the new series right now. The one thing we do know is it's set in the sort of future of anything that we've seen in the main timeline. So not the weird, strange movie throw off timeline that J.J. Abrams did. It's all in the normal main timeline. It's set after the events of Nemesis and the 2009 Star Trek movie. There were some key points in the 2009 movie which related to the initial Star Trek timeline, in that Spock was trying to save the Romulan homeworld, which is when he ended up going through that red matter supernova portal thingy, which threw him into the different timeline. Spock fails to save Romulus and it explodes. And it's sort of post that cataclysmic event that has really changed things for Picard. So there's the sort of dissolution of the Romulan Empire. It sort of radically altered the life that Picard was having. It seems that we're going to be dealing with Romulans in some way in this timeline, but we don't know exactly what.
And Patrick Stewart's in.
Yes, and Patrick Stewart's totally in. Yes, it is in. It's going. It's happening. They've done script reads. I don't know whether they're actually shooting yet, but I mean, it is in the bag. It is definitely happening.
Great.
So Santiago is somebody that might not be a name you know, but it is somebody that you may recognize. He's a Venezuelan actor, but he's been on Heroes, where he played the comic book artist in. You can or put comic book author in that, Isaac. He was in Merlin, where he played Lancelot. He played Aramis in The Musketeers. So he's been, for some reason, he was over here quite a lot doing British TV shows.
He's around, sure.
Yes, he's around. He's been starring in Salvation, which I think is on Netflix over here. It's a CBS show. Michelle Hurd has been in a whole ton of stuff over the years. Law and Order SVU, ER, 90210, Devious Maid she was in. I think most recently people will know her mainly as playing Shepherd in Blindspot, or she played the DA Samantha Reese in Daredevil as well. She also plays Renee Grover, Lou Grover's wife in Hawaii Five-O, which is a sort of guest role that she pops up in every so often. And she was in Lethal Weapon as well. So, yes, she's not short of work, that lady. Don't know what they're going to be playing at the moment, or at least no official word on what they're playing. The rumour is that Santiago is playing a skilled thief and the pilot of Picard's ship, whatever that happens to be. Presumably it's not the Enterprise, because he's supposed to be, I think, retired at this point. And her role is supposed to be a former intelligence officer with a history of drug and alcohol abuse. However, despite her background, she's still a brilliant analyst and has amazing memory retention. That's rumored to be what they're playing, but that might not be correct. We'll have to see. They have said that the Picard series is supposed to be coming later in 2019, although as far as we're aware, they're not shooting it yet, or maybe they are. I mean, I don't know. But I suspect it'll be at the very tail end of 2019 when it does arrive, but that seems like a fairly fast time turnaround for it.
Christmas special, let's go.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a series, so we'll have to see. No news on a UK pickup yet, but you've got to imagine that Netflix are going to go after it.
Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they seem to be home for most things Star Trek at this point. I mean, you know, and they're running Discovery, and that's been a big success for them. So I rather suspect they'll pick this up as well. Moving on to comic book adaptations, there is an adaptation coming of a book called Resident Alien, and it's going to be starring everybody's favourite pilot, Alan Tudyk, who, of course, was in Firefly.
Do you think Alan Tudyk ever gets the call and just thinks, nah, don't think this one? Because he's always saying yes to stuff. He's always in the thing, whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to pop up in the weirdest of places. He does a ton of voiceover work as well. I'd got to play one of the Waynes, one of the lesser-known Waynes. He was a cousin of Bruce Wayne on that short-lived NBC show, which was about the people that kind of insure superheroes, wasn't it, I think?
Oh, right.
He was on that as well. So he's done a little bit in sort of DC. He does a ton of voiceover work and then sort of pops up in all sorts of things.
Let's do an Alan Tudyk-averse where it's just his characters from different, you know, comic book properties.
That would be great. That would be great. And of course, played Wash in Firefly. So, Resident Alien is described as a twisted and comedic fish out of water story. The show follows an alien who crash lands on Earth and assumes the identity of a small town Colorado doctor named Harry Vandersmeel, which includes its character, only to face the moral quandary of whether human beings are actually worth saving. I mean, that description makes it sound like the perfect role for Alan Tudyk. I mean, I really, really see him fitting into a role like
He's in, but he's sort of out of place in some way. way.
Yeah, and that seems very, very much him sort of thing. As well as being watching Firefly, he's been in Maze Runner films, he was in Powerless, he was in Trumbo, he was lent his voice, I think he was voice and mocap for Rogue One, played the main robot in Rogue One.
The main robot.
Pops up in The Tick, Doom Patrol, where he's technically voicing a character, I think. But he's done stuff for Family Guy, Rick and Morty, Adventure Time, Zootopia, Big Hero 6, Moana. So yeah, a whole bunch of stuff. And go and check out Con Man if you haven't, because it's hilarious as well. It's well worth watching. So yeah, the other casting they've announced is Sarah Tomanko, who was in Once Upon a Time, Corey Reynolds, who was in The Closer, Alex Wetterland, who was in People of Earth, and Levi Feischler, who is in Mars, which is a great show as well. So yeah, that's the cast for that. I don't know the comic book at all. It's another Dark Horse Comics. Dark Horse seem to be doing quite well selling their stuff on.
That's good.
Being commissioned by Sci-Fi US, which does not mean that it'll end up on Sci-Fi UK over here. It could end up anywhere. They don't work like that, unfortunately. They've not set a premiere date for it as well. I suspect it'll be an autumn one for them, but we'll have to wait and see. And lastly, the Amazon Lord of the Rings series, which has been very quiet up until quite recently. They've been slowly dropping maps or pictures of maps out onto the Twitter feed, and sort of adding little bits more detail each time. And as they've added more detail, it's sort of not until the latest map has come out where they've finally come out and said that the show will be set in the second age of Tolkien's Middle Earth. If that means nothing to you, I will try and explain what that means. How much Lord of the Rings Tolkien stuff are you aware of?
Lord of the Rings is the third age, isn't it? Like the actual series, right?
Yes.
And an age, to me, Dave, an amateur, sounds like a long time. We're talking 100 years or something, maybe even more, because people are old in Lord of the Rings.
About 10 times that, yes.
So we're talking century before Lord of the Rings happens.
Yeah, no, well, we're talking, well, you're talking about 1,000 times that, actually. I mean, the Second Age is a long time in the past. It's before the Fellowship go to Mordor, it's before Bilbo meets the dragon, it's way, way before all that. We saw a little bit of the Second Age on screen in the opening moments of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. If you remember, there was a big battle sequence, which you have the last alliance of elves and men battling the physical incarnation of Sauron, leads to him being physically defeated, heads back to Mordor to basically become a giant eye on the top of a tower. That's the end of the Second Age. So that's right at the end of the Second Age, that period.
So we might have sort of, well, depending on what part of the Second Age it's in, we might have some sort of Sauron rise to power situation.
Sauron, I suspect, will very much be part of it. The entire period of the Second Age spans 3,441 years.
Terrific.
Which is oddly specific, which being Tolkien is very specific, of course.
They should go to a decimal system and just make it like 10.
Yeah.
Like end it in a round number.
Yes, totally. So the Second Age is a period of time where dwarves are flourishing in Khazad Dûm, which is later what becomes known as Moria, which is the place with the Balrog and the troll and all that sort of stuff under the Misty Mountains, yes. Elrond, who is very, very, very old, is founding Rivendell during this period as well. There's also the time when the Rings of Power are created. So the elves and the One Ring are created mainly by the elves, but Sauron's kind of got his fingers in manipulating them into creating the rings, essentially.
Right.
The announcement of it being in the Second Age was quite a sort of major thing, because there was a lot of people talking about, oh, well, rumours are it's going to be a young Aragorn series. It's not going to be that, because Aragorn was nowhere near being alive at that point. One of the things that is going to feature is on the maps that they sent out, there's Numenor, which I think I'm pronouncing that right. Apologies, Tolkien scholars, if I'm not. There's an island which is off the side of Middle Earth, which was the Kingdom of Men. It's not something that you usually find on a Middle Earth map, because it was sunk by the Valar, basically, are the gods of Middle Earth, after the inhabitants disobeyed them when the king was corrupted by Sauron. So all Sauron's fault again. And the gods basically got upset and sank the entire island. This is the place where Aragorn's bloodline comes from, though. It's where the sort of royal bloodline comes from. So there is a very good chance that we'll see relatives of Aragorn, but, you know, the great, great, great times are lots of grandparents and stuff. And the fact that it's there suggests that it may be set around on that island, quite possibly. That also gives you some idea of the time period, because the island was destroyed 122 years prior to that battle at the end of the Second Age. So unless you're running up right until that point where they actually destroy it, it's going to be set much earlier than that.
So
in the timeline,
we're at least towards the end, possibly.
Well, you may be towards the end. I mean, that island has been around for most of the Second Age. So
great, terrific. So we know nothing like we knew before.
No, we don't know anything for sure, but my gut feeling is there's a 200 year period in the middle of the Second Age from about 1500 to 1700 that covers the forging of the Rings of Power, the founding of Rivendell, the War of the Elves with Sauron as well. So there is a nice big battle in there. You've got the rings being created. You've got Rivendell being made. That seems like a solid time period to pick out. That sort of 200-year gap seems like a good area to set it in.
People know the words and the places and stuff. Even people who aren't into it, like, know the words, right?
Yeah, and it's the forging of the Rings of Power, which is sort of, you know, an important element. It's interesting as well, because this is the first time, I think, that anybody has been allowed to tamper with stuff that wasn't either The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I mean, they did it a little bit with The Hobbit books, and they kind of, you know, but a lot of that was, some of it was pulled from some of the other books, but some of it was also made up as well by Peter Jackson. So he's tweaked a few things here and there. This is, a lot of the stuff comes out of other work which was finished after Tolkien died. It's interesting because it's the first time they've actually been allowed to, you know, anybody's been allowed to play with this sort of stuff, which is possibly why they spend so much money on it. So there's no casting or air date info or anything else for the Lord of the Rings series yet. We don't know when it's going to arrive. My guess is you may see something in 2020, but given the scale of it, it could very well be 2021, 2022. So who knows?
So this is LOTR on Prime on Twitter.
Yes.
And they've got maps on there.
Yeah, and they've got the maps on there, and they are tweeting out little teasers. So if you are a Lord of the Rings fan and you're excited for this, go and follow that Twitter handle, because they are dropping little hints and teasers and bits and pieces. So that's certainly where the news seems to be coming out of. It's amazing the amount of stuff you can get from them just sticking an island on a map as well.
So, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But I am very much looking forward to that. It should be really interesting when it eventually drops. That's all the news for this week. Next, we'll move on to the interview.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The interview this week is with composer Dan Morocco, who works on a little comedy series you may have heard of called Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Previously, he's worked on films such as Demonic and Brotherhood, and he's also worked on the TV series Say Yes to the Dress. He's worked on shows such as Lie to Me and Life on Mars, the American remake, that is. Dirty Sexy Money he did some work on as well. So a whole lot of different things. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is his main focus at the moment, and he does sort of other projects in between. So we chat a bit to him about the cancellation and subsequent rescue by NBC last year. This was recorded prior to us knowing that it had got renewed for a new season as well. So I don't mention the latest renewal in here. If you're wondering why I didn't bring that up, this was recorded before then. Here's the interview with Dan. We'll see you afterwards with some highlights for next week on TV. It's lovely to have you on, because I mean, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is such a good show. Obviously went through a little bit of trauma at the middle of last year, I guess.
Yeah.
Did you know the cancellation was coming? Did you? How soon did you know that NBC were kind of getting involved to rescue it? Did you know much about that situation?
I mean, I had no inside information, but obviously it's my job and this is what I spend a lot of time on. So I've been watching the ratings and everything to check and see how it was looking. So I knew it was kind of 50-50, but it felt like towards the end of the season five, that it was getting some signs that maybe it was looking a little more positive. So I thought I was prepared for the show. Like, if it's canceled, okay, well, I'll move on. And it was a great run and a fun show to work on. But then when it actually was canceled, I was pretty shocked and super disappointed. But luckily, it didn't last too long.
It was like 2 days and NBC stepped in and picked it up again, which was a great move by them. I mean, it seems to have been doing phenomenal ratings for NBC. I mean, it seems to have been doing really well over there. And they've added more episodes, haven't they? So
it's been all encouraging signs, and they've done so much to promote the show. And so it's been great so far. And it was NBC picking it up was not really on my horizon. I was looking for Hulu or Netflix or maybe TBS, where it's syndicated here in the States. I thought maybe one of those. And then those, right about a day after the cancellation, there was kind of a series of tweets, basically, is how I was finding everything out. But there was a series of tweets saying that Netflix had passed, Hulu had passed, TBS wasn't interested. So then I was just like, oh, man, like it's really done. It's really done now. And then, 4 or 5 hours after that, I saw that NBC had picked us up for another season, and was elated.
Yeah, so it's funny you're finding out exactly the same way that pretty much everybody else did, by the sense of it. So.
Oh no, absolutely. I was in the I was in the doctor's office. I had a broken toe, so I was sitting waiting for the doctor, and it just popped up on my phone. I had my alert set, popped up on my phone. Fox cancels Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I was just like, oh, that was.
I might have some time on my hands.
Yeah, that's big news to receive just sitting here. Waiting for the doctor. But and then likewise, when it was picked back up, I was at my favorite divey Mexican restaurant having margaritas with a friend, kind of drowning my sorrows. And my wife called and said, it got picked up. NBC picked it up. And I was behind the times on that one a little bit, because some random person had messaged her on Facebook that it was picked up. Like, we had given up at that point. So it was kind of funny, the chain of events to learn the news. But it was great to hear.
Absolutely, it's great to have it back. And as I say, it seems to be doing really well for NBC, so that's a really positive sign. We should really talk a little bit about the music, soon as that's what you're here for. So let's start off with a little bit of background. How did you get into composing in the first place?
So composing, I kind of always been around music. My dad was a music teacher high school, so I played piano pretty young and played the trumpet and picked up the guitar and, have been around music, but didn't really consider composing until I was in university at NYU. At that point, I thought I wanted to be a record producer or work at a record label or something like that.
Right.
But I got an internship at a company that mainly did music for commercials. So I started writing music for commercials, and that was kind of a fun way to get into writing a lot of different kinds of music and learning how to work with picture and being able to write music with the set of guidelines that comes with writing to picture. And I find the kind of guidelines that you get with picture more inspiring than limiting, It helps me kind of get my creative process going when I have, okay, I need to do this, and put them all together. That helps me get moving, as opposed to just having a blank page of, okay, just write something wonderful. So I just started enjoying it. A lot of my friends in college were film students, so I started doing music for their short films and kind of early projects, and eventually moved. That was in New York. Eventually moved out to Los Angeles and got into writing for TV and assisting on some films and stuff, doing a few films of my own.
How did Brooklyn Nine-Nine come to you?
A friend from college who is an editor, or was an editor, now she's a director, but she was editing the pilot, and I had recently done some work for her on another show. So she called me up to get an early start on it. So I was working really at the first kind of editor's, director's cut.
Wow.
I was already starting to write some music for it. So by the time it was a locked cut, that it already had a lot of my music in it. And
that's definitely the way you convince people that you're the right person for the gig.
Yes. Well, yeah, and then, you know, it wasn't even my, you know, it wasn't my job even after the pilot that was, you know, 95% my music.
Yeah.
It still wasn't like, oh, well, clearly you're hired. I still had to go through an interview and go through the process and everything. And luckily they were happy enough with the way the pilot turned out that they kept me on board for the show and, you know, had me do the theme song and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing with TV, you know, I was very fortunate to have somebody kind of know I could do the work and call me up to help them out and help me out. But as fortunate as that is, the number of pilots that people even stay to the end on is pretty limited. And then of those pilots, the one that get picked up, and then of those, the ones that make it more than 13 episodes and, you know, and then into six seasons it's just at each stage, it's like a super lucky kind of thing, just multiplied on top of each other. So I feel very fortunate to be a part of the show. It's been great.
Yeah. I mean, the other slightly odd thing with this as well is the fact that you ended up doing the theme tune as well, because that quite often isn't the case. The theme ends up going to somebody else entirely, and then somebody gets brought on to do the main thing. I mean, it's, having spoken to 30, 40 composers at this point, there's only one or two that have actually done the theme and ended up doing the main show as well.
It's surprisingly rare that it's connected. I have definitely demoed and tried the themes on other shows and that I had no part in the scoring part of, but yeah, I was very excited to get to, I'm sure the idea was, well, let's give this guy a shot and see how he does. And then if he doesn't, we can always, you know, go out to everybody and see what we come back with. I know on the producer's previous shows, it was kind of a send it out to everybody and see who comes back with the best thing. And that was kind of the plan, which to my knowledge, they didn't do on this, but I guess it's not impossible.
Yeah.
But no, I was excited to do it. And the producers had a pretty good start of an idea of what kind of thing they wanted. And it, you know, having already done the pilot, it helped to understand the energy of the show and the kind of sound that was going for as a whole with the show. Took several passes at it to get it right, but that was the most kind of collaborative with the producers and everything of anything I've worked on the show. It's definitely, there was a lot of back and forth. I even got notes from Andy Samberg at one point on it. So, which incidentally, I don't know if you're a fan of his work on Saturday Night Live, but my favorite of his notes was that he wanted some laser sounds in it, which there are subtly some laser sounds in it. But at the time, he was just coming off Saturday Night Live, where he was one of the guys behind Laser Cats, the sketch that they were doing.
Right, okay.
So I thought that was pretty great to get my first big show theme song, to get the note from the creator of Laser Cats to add more lasers to the theme song.
That's awesome.
They actually, at first I was like, that's silly. Like that's a silly note. I put them in and was like, you know what? That's fun.
Weirdly, that works.
Yeah.
So how did you start to approach the music to? I mean, you say obviously you're getting notes back and all that sort of stuff. It's a cop show, but it's a sort of comedy cop show. Did you look at traditional cop show scores and things to sort of guide it in any way? Or was it coming from a completely different place?
So I had assisted on several police shows, hour-long dramas recently before starting Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And there was the US version of Life on Mars.
Yes.
And Lie to Me, which is more of a detective kind of thing, right?
loved that show. Yeah.
One that ran on CBS here for a while called NYC 22, which was very cops on the beat kind of show.
Yeah.
So I had a string of pretty legit, I was assisting on those, but you know, I had a string of pretty legit, these are police shows that I had worked on. So I definitely already had a feel of, okay, this is the sound of police music that was definitely inspired by those earlier 70s, 80s kind of police shows.
Yeah.
And then I had also done a small comedy on Adult Swim here in the States called NTSF SD SUV, which is Paul Scheer created it. It was a spoof on the CSIs, NCIS, and you know, all those that were taking off. So, and that one, it was a comedy, very much a spoof. So the music had to play over the top, legit police sound. You know, there was no trying to be funny about it. It was, it was definitely trying to be, the more serious, the more funny it was, basically. So I had all this cop background. And I think, honestly, that's why once I got to the interview process on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I think that probably put me over the top.
Yeah,
because the producers doing The Office and Parks and Rec before had never really used score in the shows. Neither of those shows have score at all. They just have a theme song, and then there are a few songs like written for a band in the show. And definitely the aesthetic at the time and still is to shy away from sitcom music, you know, with the just the transitions and bumpers and those kind of things and the stings. So I think their idea for the show was, well, we have police action, we're going to need music for the police action. So we need somebody to play that who can help us out in the comedy department a little bit occasionally. But for the most part, we need somebody who can make the action entertaining.
Yeah.
So I think that's how I came on to it, that kind of felt like a good fit for them.
It's interesting because the show isn't wall-to-wall music like some series are. So how much are you writing per episode, do you reckon?
You know, at this point, we have so many cues in a library that I probably could get away with writing less, but I probably write 20 cues, you know, 20 starts roughly.
Okay.
Maybe 18 or something, you know, but I would probably 15 to 20 is safe that I write each episode, and it ranges from 4 to 8 minutes worth of music in a 22 minute episode.
Yeah.
And mainly the action stuff, but we kind of have found a style of intro into a scene or transition that doesn't feel too sitcom-y, but helps the audience transition from one scene to another. Or, you know, if we do a time jump and cut between sets in the office, you know, in the police precinct, it helps to have a little music to let you know, okay, this isn't a direct cut. We're definitely, this is a new scene we're cutting to. So.
Yeah, yeah. Quite a lot of it appears to be sort of very guitar-based, I guess.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
Because you've got some of the tracks up on your website as well. So I was listening to that. It's a great use of rock jazz flute in one of those.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones. That's that theme with the flute is one that is a recurring theme in the Halloween episode. So every season we've had a Halloween episode that's all about a big heist, and each season somebody different wins it. And at the end, they always have a scene explaining how they've tricked everyone, how they've managed to win the heist. So each year we've gone with that same theme. And the one with the flute is a personal favorite of mine. And I try and bring the flute back in now in future ones. But that was the one when Captain Holt won, and he was referencing Franz Blüheim, the flautist. So so I decided for Holt's winning season of the Halloween heist that he should have a flute running through it all. So that was a lot of fun.
Come beat some rock jazz flute in there, definitely.
Yeah, it really, there's a few of those. You know, in the second episode of season 6, I may have beat the rock jazz flute. I got to say the opening has some really solid saxophone in it.
So. Awesome. I'll have to watch out for that. Yeah, yeah. So is this the first show you've been kind of main composer? I mean, you've done, as you say, you've done sort of Adult Swim stuff as well.
Yeah, this is the first big time broadcast network one that has been solely mine. And it's fun. It's great to be in charge of it and getting to make the choices on everything. And, you know, a lot of composers have pretty big teams and they take on 3 or 4 shows at a time. And from my experience, when you've got a bunch of projects going on and just from getting to all the meetings and managing what everyone else is doing to make sure everything gets done on time, there's not a lot of time to actually write music. You know, maybe you write, if you're the top guy on these 4 shows, you maybe write a few cues here and a few cues there and a few cues there and send it out and try and do your best to manage everything that's coming in and going out. And I very consciously decided I'd like to write music. I'd like to be the one really doing it. So yeah, it's fun to be in the position to be able to be in control of how much I can do on it and really get to write some fun music for the show.
I can entirely understand that. I mean, yeah, because I know some of the guys will have like, you know, five shows going at once. You think, how could you do this? This is ridiculous.
I don't understand it personally. Like, yeah. I even with the teams and everything, I think the most I was at the very beginning of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I had that NTSF show was kind of wrapping up and I was doing a film and I was doing Brooklyn Nine-Nine for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the show. And at the same time, the theme song was another added project. And that was a completely mad time. So I can't imagine how people do it. And, you know, that was about a 4 week period where it was just like nonstop. I can't imagine how the people do it who have five things running like that, 9 to 12 months out of the year. That seems crazy to me. But, you know, the other thing, the other part of it, why kind of I've consciously taken that path is I did work very briefly. I just rented a room really from one of the biggest composers out there, has a spot in Santa Monica with a huge team of people.
That wouldn't be Hans Zimmer by any chance, would it?
I'm not saying anything, but that's a machine of its own. It's impressive. I saw how that worked. And then I also was fortunate enough to work with Alexander Desplat and Javier Navarrete a decent amount when they were out here, when they've come out to LA and worked out here. I was their kind of point person for a long time. I shouldn't group them together individually. You know, they're totally separate things. But and they both were completely differently in, they are the ones writing the music. They're sitting there in front of the computer doing the music from start to finish. And then when you get to the approved pieces and you're ready to record, then you obviously have to have a team to get you from the computer to the finished recorded orchestra on the big films. But really in the writing process, it was fun to see guys, even, you know, guys who are like Alexandre is so busy, you know, at that point he was doing, and I mean, he still is, but he's doing 8 films a year, something like that.
Jeez.
And of the highest level films, and he's doing them all and writing them all and coming up with something unique for them and just fully engaged in it. And not just, you know, he's not at all a manager of his operation. He's just writing the music, which is, you know, that's why I got into it, just because I enjoyed writing the music. So that definitely seemed like, okay, well, if I have a choice, that's definitely the path I would like to take, of being able to be the one to write the music.
So. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why you get into the job in the first place. So, you know, I totally get that.
I will say it does have its drawbacks, because, you know, I've taken on one show and I love it and I'm working real hard on it. And like I saw, you know, whatever it was 9 months ago, that can be taken away very quickly.
Yeah.
And then you're starting from square one again. But it's been great while I've been working on it, and great that I get to keep working on it.
You need like something that you could just sort of have running maybe alongside, just in case.
Yeah. I wouldn't be opposed to a summer show so that I could kind of go back and forth. And I will say it is fun. I have done other projects over the summers, and it is fun to have something new to work on to kind of just refresh your mind, and maybe you find some instruments for that were never seemed like something you would reach for on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but then you're like, oh, but that was really cool. I bet I could use that in this queue, you know, when you go back to Brooklyn Nine-Nine, or, you know, between projects. So it is helpful to be able to have some other creative outlets to inspire new ideas too. But
I mean, you want a little bit of variation. I mean, you did an orchestral score for the film Demonic, didn't you? That sort of kind of almost as far away as you can get from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
And as I mentioned, that's the film that I was working on right at the start of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I was kind of wrapping that up as I was getting to Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So there wasn't a lot of transfer from, you know, like I'm saying, you pick up an instrument. There wasn't a lot of that for Brooklyn Nine-Nine to Demonic, but it was still fun to be able to switch gears, and surprisingly not that difficult to jump between the two as I was doing it, because, you know, you look at the picture and, you know, hit play and hear everything that's going on, and suddenly it's like, okay, now I'm in this place. And it was surprisingly not that difficult to jump back and forth as needed on those.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've interviewed Dominic Lewis, who is the composer for DuckTales, but he's also the composer for Man in the High Castle. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's quite good to have the opposite ends, you know.
It's surprising how far I'll get into my rhythm on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I feel like I'm writing a very similar piece of music over and over, and just kind of tailoring it to the needs of the scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, then my agent will ask for a reel for something else totally different, and I'll go back through some old music and listen. It's like, wow, I wrote that? Like, huh. Like, that just feels so foreign right now. But you get on the project and looking at the picture and, you know, into the story, and it's fun to see where it can inspire you.
Yeah. I've got a couple of final questions that we ask everybody. First one is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
What am I watching? I just finished Killing Eve. I really enjoyed that one.
Great show.
And just finished up Friends from College. It was a Netflix show.
Yeah.
And Good Place is one that
I love that a lot. Yeah. It's amazing, that show. Yeah.
And of course, I'm waiting for my Game of Thrones and those kind of ones to come back on air. But definitely on air right now. Good Place is probably the one I'm most excited to tune in. Yeah. And it's a partner with Brooklyn Nine-Nine, at least here in the US, they air back to back. So that's
cool. Fun.
There's plenty I watch. I love TV. So,
So the last question is, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present, or future, not one you've worked on, which show would it be?
Oh, that is tough, isn't it? There's so many good options. Maybe Breaking Bad. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's such a range there. And what they do that's so fun, which is very different from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is just wall-to-wall dialogue, basically. So there's always jokes. And so a lot of my job is working around the jokes. So there are only very particular moments where music can really pop out and be featured.
Yeah.
But aside from just the subject of Breaking Bad just being so interesting and everything about the production of it being so great, they really milk moments, you know, so they really let things marinate for a while. And there's usually really fun music. There's, you know, there's opportunities to do something really cool with the music on that in those spaces. So it gives you a place to really do something good.
Yeah. It's a popular show that, and it was an amazing series. So Well, I will let you get back to your work and your day. It's been lovely to talk to you. Hopefully we can have you back on at some point in the future, maybe when the next season of Brooklyn Nine-Nine comes out.
That would be great. I'd love to.
Awesome. Well, have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Speak to you soon. Yeah. Cheers. Yeah,
thanks for having me on. Bye.
Bye. So that was the interview with Dan Morocco, the composer of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. We don't yet know exactly when Brooklyn Nine-Nine's coming back. I was told it is going to be fairly soon on E4 in the UK. Hopefully we'll find out relatively soon when that actually is, but we're still waiting for E4 to sort it out at the moment. We'll let you know, check the website and check the air dates and stuff, and we'll let you know when it is coming back. Now we have some highlights for next week on TV. Highlights for next week on TV. We have Bounty Hunters returning for a second season on Sky One. That's on the 13th of March at 8 p.m. That's the Jack Whitehall and Rosie Perez comedy. Did you watch any of the first season of this?
No, I didn't.
It was quite funny. Very Jack Whitehall in places, but, you know, has a bit more kind of action in it. It's really strange seeing Jack Whitehall in an action comedy, but worth watching, certainly. Madam Secretary back on Sky Witness for the second half of its fifth season. That's on the 14th of March at 10 p.m. Arrested Development is back for the second half of season 5. That's on the 15th of March on Netflix. Also on Netflix on the 15th of March, you've got Queer Eye, the third season of that is back.
All good.
Yes, and there's a new Idris Elba show on the 15th of March on Netflix as well, which is called Turn Up Charlie. He plays a struggling DJ, an eternal bachelor, who is given a final chance at success when he reluctantly becomes a Manny to his famous Best Friends Problem Child daughter.
Like a Manny has entered the popular vernacular.
Yes, I know. Looks like a comedy to me, or dramedy kind of thing.
Certainly set up that way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's single camera comedy sort of setup by the looks of things. But it looks quite funny, so could be worth watching. Mm. And it's Idris Elba. It's stretching his legs again, so always worth. Prove Innocent, which is on Universal TV on the 18th of March at 9 p.m. That's a legal drama set at a wrongful conviction firm led by a fierce and fearless female lawyer with a hunger for justice. The team reopens investigations, putting their own lives in danger to exonerate exonerate the innocent that were proven guilty. It's got Frasier in it as well. That
Frasier.
I can't remember the man's name. What's the guy's name?
Kelsey Grammer.
Kelsey Grammer. Yes, got Kelsey Grammer.
I'm sure he responds to Frasier in the street.
I'm sure if you shouted out to him, yes, don't shout Frasier and Kelsey Grammer. He would get very upset. If you don't advocate that, you might get smacked in the face. So prove innocent. Look, if you're into those sort of legal dramas, I think could be quite interesting. So one to definitely watch out for. That's on the 18th of March on Universal at 9 p.m. And that's everything for this week, unless you've got anything else you want to add in.
No, that's it. I'll go and see Captain Marvel and we can compare notes, Dave.
Yes, definitely do that. I would thoroughly recommend people go and see Captain Marvel. It is worth
two post-credit scenes.
Stick around, although if you have to run off, don't worry too much about missing the last one.
The good ones at the start, that's nice, isn't it? Because if the good ones at the end, it's like, oh, I'm going to wait.
The second one's cute, but you don't need to hang around for it necessarily. For us, if you want to find out more information throughout the week, go to geektown.co.uk and get all the latest air date info. If you want to get in touch with your questions and comments, email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/geektown, and on Instagram at geektownuk. That is everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.